Coming up on Boston Public Radio, Cambridge debates privacy versus safety versus catching criminals with security cameras to turn them on or not. Then, do you eat the cream filling first in your Oreo cookies? Well, guess what? That makes you enjoy those Oreos more. Then, the science of gambling addiction, including why it's so hard for so many to get up and walk away from slot machines or what we used to call one-armed bandits.
All right, and later, Boston Globe editor Brian McGrory on whether the FBI is still in the crosshairs after the Whitey Bulger verdict. Then, could you believe that Globe story about Park Plaza Hotel magnate Lisa Saunders? She commandeered her own private valet spot right in front of the hotel. And Newton's own Mark Leibovich with his hot new book on Washington power players. This town, that's all coming up on Boston Public Radio.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
I am Marjorie Egan. She is Emily Rooney from Greater Boston, filling in for the vacationing Jim Browdy. This is Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. No more Whitey Bulger trial today, Emily Rooney, except for a brief conversation with the editor of the Boston Globe, Brian.
I know, I'm in withdrawal. How about you?
I know. It's like, what do we do now? Well, we are going to start by talking about a debate that's been getting increasingly heated after the Boston Marathon bombings. Should the use of more security cameras and surveillance techniques increase? Should we be doing it more often? Cambridge is wrestling with that debate right now. And joining us to talk about what they're doing in Cambridge and facing and what they must decide is City Councilor Craig Kelly. Councilor Kelly, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
So, Councilor, the City Council voted to go ahead and put them on. What's the issue? I know there's been some pushback.
But you aren't entirely correct. We haven't voted to put them on. Years ago.
You did years ago. In 2009, you did.
Years ago, we passed essentially a resolution, an opinion, saying we didn't want the Homeland Security cameras turned on, and they haven't been turned on.
Yeah, you've got them. You've installed them in all these places.
They're there. But why not? What's the issue?
Well, the issue back then was there was fear that the cameras would collect data that then would be shared with the Boston Regional Intelligence Center, the BRIC, or the Fusion Center, depending on the term you use. And that data would then allow people that manipulate it to come up with stories of whatever sort and sort of wrestle their way into people's private lives in ways that most of us can't really understand or anticipate. And I think when we use the term camera, it's the term that everyone uses, but it's somewhat misleading because for me, a camera is what my mom used to take pictures of when I was a kid, and you'd take the roll out and you'd take it to the place that developed it, and then you'd get the slide and you'd hold it up to the light and try and figure out whether you could show it to your grandmother. These things do much more than that. They capture detail that I can't even imagine, and then the software that analyzes it can run it through all sorts of different databases and so forth and come up with what I call stories about whoever's in the picture, connected to other dots. And that's the part that freaked us out back then, and I think that's the part that freaks people out now.
But I guess what I find, this is Marjorie Egan, Councillor Kelly, what I find interesting about this is absolutely true. The data is out. The evidence is out on whether or not it prevents crime. So far, there's no indication that it does prevent crime. But what these cameras absolutely do is catch criminals. And that's the big issue. And somehow, I said this to Emily before the show, I'm reminded of all the, I'm drawing a broad brush here about your Cambridge citizenry, but I'm reminding of the people, Councillor, who were upset they weren't on Nixon's enemies list way back in the 70s. You know, all these people with these ideas that somebody wants to follow them around and tell stories about them. I mean, who cares about 99% of the people in Boston or Cambridge or any place else? You know what I mean? I mean, what story are they going to make up about you, Councillor Kelly, that you were parking in a handicapped spot or something
like
that?
If I had a story, I certainly wouldn't tell you right now. But I think when you say they're certainly used to catch criminals, well, sure they are. They're also certainly used to do all sorts of other things. And you know, you don't have to look very far. You were just talking about the Whitey Bulger case. right? You don't have to look very far to see instances where people with government authority working on government behalf, using government equipment, do things that the general public says, wait a minute, that's not supposed to happen. A few weeks ago or months ago, there was a story about the NSA doing stuff with the access to people's records that they didn't really think the NSA would be accessing.
Right, but not everybody was upset by that.
Excuse me?
Some people were upset by that and some people weren't. And what was the Whitey Bulger situation? Those were criminals.
Yeah, so all I'm saying is, you know, you ask what story could conceivably come out of my life or anyone else's life. I don't know, but I do know that information and equipment and so forth is not always used in appropriate ways.
But that's
what we're concerned about in Cambridge.
But isn't the issue whether this is actually more for the public good than and it could override any concern for privacy? For instance, your police department says that last week when that beer truck fell over on 93 and it jammed up traffic all over the Boston region, that they could have looked at that video coming from your cameras and diverted traffic. That's just one example, or they're saying they could have put out, you know, some kind of an alert citywide that would have told people what detour routes to have taken if they had that that video stream.
Yes, that's what they say. And they say the same thing about the Leverett Circle sinkhole. And it's possible. In my experience in Cambridge traffic is that once it gets bad, no amount of traffic cameras is going to solve the problem. But, you know, arguably there are uses for cameras. And I think what we're trying to do in the city of Cambridge is figure out what the appropriate use, not just for these Homeland Security cameras, but future cameras that the Cambridge Police Department might get, whether they buy them out of their own budget or the Department of Homeland Security or someone else gives them to them, what other policies and procedures we might need to make sure these cameras that we have now and ones we might get in the future are used as efficiently as possible to give the police the best tools that they need, while at the same time protecting people's reasonable expectations of privacy.
We're talking with Cambridge City Councilor Craig Kelly. They're debating over in Cambridge whether to actually turn on these cameras that have been sitting there, which is kind of ridiculous in itself. You've got cameras in six different locations. Brookline uses them.
Yeah.
There have been restrictions on when they can use them in certain hours of the day and so forth. And I should point out, actually, Councilor, that this is what changed my mind on security cameras, where there was this absolutely horrific rape in Coolidge Corner in Brookline occurred after midnight. There were cameras in the corner, Coolidge Corner, which enabled the rapist to be caught. It's very, very difficult to prove these kind of crimes. A woman was coming home from the airport. She was walking to her apartment. She was kidnapped, raped, abducted. These guys got 20 and 25 years in prison. And I guess I would ask you, Counselor, why do people have any expectation of privacy at the corner of Harvard Street and Beacon Street in Brookline? Or why do people have an expectation of privacy walking around Kendall Square or Harvard Square? The stores all have cameras. We know that the Forum restaurant is what provided the video that enabled us to catch the bombers in the marathon. Why the expectation of privacy?
Well, I think you're conflating two issues. One is, do people get on camera whenever it is they go someplace public? And is that something that they should expect not to happen? And the answer is they do get on camera and they expect to get on camera. The bigger issue for a lot of people, to include myself, is once your information has been on camera, and again, when we say the word camera, I think we're using an archaic term. We just haven't come up with a better one to explain what these things really do in terms of gathering data. But once you've been on camera, what is it that happens to that information? And that's the part that, in my experience, has people the most worried. So the Cambridge policy would have the information collected, and it would have the information stored for 45 days, but it would have very limited access in terms of other people coming in, whether it's the NSA or the CIA or, you know, whoever wants to just sort through this data and see what they can find.
So anybody could look at it? Who would be
looking
at
it? Well, no, we would argue that anybody can't look at it. Yeah, we don't want to share it with the Fusion Center. We don't want to share it with the BRIC.
But
if someone wants it, for example, if there were a rape, if there were an accident, if there were whatever, and that information would have been useful or would be useful, then someone would come in and under certain guidelines, whether it's a subpoena or whatnot, they would have access to the information.
That's reasonable. But are you suggesting that somebody would be looking at all of that? Would be somebody's job to do nothing but look at those, you know, that whatever streaming video is captured on that?
It wouldn't be someone's job.
No, but I know. Are you saying that that's the way it would work now? If you just went and flipped those cameras on, there would be anybody could look at it, or not anybody, but Homeland Security, and you just want to be able to turn it over when it's upon request.
Right now, it's, I believe, a little bit vague. I don't know, for example, who has access to Brookline's data. We want Cambridge Police to have control over its data, and if the Homeland Security people or anyone else, if someone's working on a slip and fall case, whatever, if they want access to that data, we want them to go through the police to get them under a set of policies that we set up. And then we want to know at the end of the year how much of this is going on.
Counselor, thank you. One last question for me, Counselor Kelly. When are you going to decide this in Cambridge?
We're hoping to have a public meeting sometime in September to air this. I've had six so far in my committee meetings.
I heard nobody showed up.
They weren't super popular. We'll leave it at that.
They weren't superly upsetting to people, too, because if they had been, they would have showed up as well, right?
I wouldn't say what's upsetting to people or what's not, but
okay.
We didn't have a lot of people at these meetings. We'll see what happens at the public meeting. But I think we have a quaint notion of privacy that technology is somewhat overtaken.
Yeah.
I also think we have a reasonable expectation that what we do is not going to be sorted through 1,000 times and put us in this weird category that we never thought of.
Well, Counselor, thank you very much for taking the time to be with us today. We appreciate it, and good luck with your next meeting in Cambridge. Maybe you can get a full house.
It is. Well, you know, you're welcome to come.
Thank you. Who's coming up next, Ms. Rooney?
All right. So it turns out when it comes to eating, certain eccentricities like tapping, I don't even get this, your can of soda before you open it, or eating the cream center of your Oreo cookie first, maybe more than just quirky, it actually might make the food taste better, if you can believe that. We're going to be talking about that next on 89.7 WGBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Emily Rooney is sitting in for Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. So, when you eat a piece of pie, do you save the crust for last? Absolutely. Do you shine your apple before taking the first bite? No, I don't, but I cut it in pieces because I like to bite into the flesh instead of into the skin. What about symmetry? Does your food have to be arranged a certain way on your plate before you dig into your meal? If you have to eat something in a certain way, it's not a neurotic tic like you may have thought. Researchers have actually found that simple rituals can enhance the enjoyment of what you eat. And the results of this study were published recently online in Psychological Science. Michael Norton worked on this study. He's at the Harvard Business School, and he's the co-author of Happy Money, The Science of Smarter Spending. Michael Norton, welcome back.
Good to be back.
So we're going to be taking some calls on this.
We're going to take some
calls. We want to hear
too.
Everybody's
yes, we
crazy
are.
Food rituals.
Great. So tell us. I mean, I think this is a common one, right?
Yeah.
Do you eat the inside of the Oreo cookie first?
I definitely have some rituals. My number one ritual is I don't just eat for the sake of eating, though. I mean, I have to have something that's really good, or I don't bother. I mean, that's why every day I walk into the cafeteria. To me, there's nothing to eat there. I'd rather have a bag of potato chips. So that's number one. So I'm very picky about what I eat. That's a ritual in itself, you know. Like,
well, Michael, was this surprising? Did you find that you were shocked to learn that people eat the inside of the Oreo cookies first?
We knew that from just chatting with people that almost everyone has some kind of food ritual with at least one kind of food that they eat. And of course, in everyday life, we use rituals all the time. Anytime there's a sports team playing, people do crazy rituals. So we know that people really like to engage in rituals across all sorts of things, and we saw lots of funny ones with food, but we didn't know if they would actually really enhance the experience or not. So people might have thought, if I do this, it's going to taste much better, but we didn't know if it really would, and that's why we did some research to say, how and why does doing these strange things and cutting it in this way actually make the apple taste better?
Yeah, tell them about the candy bar experiment.
So the simplest one we did was literally just took a regular Hershey's candy bar. Those are nice because they come in little squares.
They do.
And they're fun to break apart, actually, especially, I was going to say for little kids, but I like to do it too.
Me too. Square at a time.
Exactly. And all we told people to do was either just eat the candy bar or break it in a certain way. So he said, break it in half and then unwrap some, and then break it again and then unwrap some, and then break it again and then unwrap some. Basically how we eat it in general, but that really systematic, ritualized way of eating it. When we asked people how good was the chocolate, it actually tasted better to them than when they just ate it the regular way. Something about that elaborate process really made the chocolate better.
So what's the science? Why does this happen?
It looks like from the data that we have is often when we eat, we're pretty mindless about it. So we're watching TV or we're talking to somebody else and we just sort of eat food and we don't think much about it. And when people engage in these rituals, one of the things it does is it really involves you in the experience. And we know from lots of things that it's good to be involved in the experience. So if you watch a movie and you're distracted, there's no way you're going to enjoy it as much as if you're really deeply into it. Rituals seem to focus us on what we're doing, and that way every single piece of chocolate tastes better. In fact, we even show that people take longer to eat the chocolate, like they're savoring every bite because they're so involved in the moment.
Our number is 877-301-8970 if you'd like to discuss your food rituals with Michael Norton and find out if they're weird neurotic tics or if they're just ways to make you enjoy the food more. Now, I think a classic one, and you talked about this in the piece, was the crusts off the pie, but crusts off sandwiches.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, when I have a grilled cheese sandwich, I eat the crusts around it first, or I cut it in four so that I can bite into the juicy melted cheese part first. I mean, I'm getting hungry even talking about this.
My favorite part is the crust, though.
Yeah. You like the crust best? I like the crust
anything
least.
Burnt or charred.
Yeah. Yeah. You guys should share sandwiches and split them every time. It's perfect.
I like the crust. I like the inside, the gooey part. Yeah. I mean, that's a great one. It talked about what I found really weird, though, this carrot ritual, because who gets excited about eating baby carrots? I mean, I just can't get excited about that. But tell people about that one.
Yeah, we thought, you know, maybe it's easy to get excited about chocolate or about wine or about these other really nice foods. And we said, I wonder if we can even make something really boring and really not emotional better by making it a ritual. And we thought, let's use a really, really boring food, which is carrots. Mm-hmm. So can we actually, by having people eat carrots in a more ritualistic way, make them taste as good as when they eat chocolate in a ritualistic way? And we have them do, again, sort of silly rituals like knocking on a table 3 times and then eating the carrot. And the more they knock on the table, the longer we have them do that, the more they like the carrot. It's crazy. But it seems to be the case that when people do rituals before they eat, something kicks in, something triggers us, we're involved in the experience, and then the carrot actually tastes better.
Now, I tried this with my corn muffin upstairs before I came down.
How did it work?
Corn muffins. I knocked on the table 3 times. I wasn't sure it tasted it. I find that one hard to believe, but you said you had, 52 kids that you studied, and this was true with these kids.
One of the things that we're really trying to do with these rituals ideas is, of course, all of us are trying to build healthy habits. And it's very hard to get excited about eating carrots. Mm-hmm. It's pretty easy to get excited about eating chocolate or a grilled cheese sandwich. It's hard to get excited about eating carrots. We're trying to see if we can use the interesting nature of rituals on boring, healthy food to build that into a habit. So carrots aren't just carrots anymore. There's something interesting that you might eat. And maybe that will lead us in the future to eat more healthy food.
What about getting people to do more presentation with their food? Is that part of it? So, I mean, some people just right out of the package, or they'll put a microwave frozen dinner and just eat it right out of the thing, as opposed to giving themselves a presentation or spending. Is that part of it too?
It is, I think. In fact, we have some other research on what we call the IKEA effect. And the idea there was actually when you make things yourself, you come to really like them more, whether it's food or putting a bookshelf together. It turns out that putting effort into things, that alone can really make you like them more, including food. And then over and above that, it seems something about the ritualistic nature of putting yourself into things makes them even better. So I think you're right. Both of those things, which we very rarely do. Usually, as you said, we just eat things out of a box. But doing both of those things really makes things much more enjoyable.
Mm-hmm. Our number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. We're talking with Michael Norton, who did this fantastic – I mean, this is just – an amazing study to me because it makes so much sense.
It does.
about how rituals, a ritualistic way or eating with little rituals, whether it's cutting off the crust or cutting the nectarine, which I also do with a knife before I eat it, or having your eggs a certain way, which is another one. You know, if they're not flipped over right so you can't like pierce the bread and the knife and have all the yolk come out.
Yeah, okay.
It's not as good. So tell us about your rituals. What do you think about this study? 877-301-8970 or our email address is bprwgbh.org. Michael, you talked about, too, the watching the ritual as opposed to participating in the ritual with opening bottles of wine. Tell people about that.
Yeah, so we wondered if it's maybe just sort of seeing a ritual at all might be the thing that really makes you happier. So if you see someone in a restaurant doing a, you know, have a sommelier who opens the wine in an elaborate way, and that probably does actually increase the experience, you know, how interesting it is.
Yeah.
But we wanted to see if you do it yourself, is it even better? And it turns out the answer is yes. So if you watch somebody knocking on the table, that's okay and doesn't really make that much of a difference. It's when you do the ritual yourself is when it really starts to hit you. I think about it actually sometimes, speaking of cutting crusts off, a lot of kids have food rituals that they don't actually do themselves.
Their parents do it
for them. So your mom or dad has to cut all the edges off the crust.
Yeah.
And that probably actually does make it better. In fact, many of our grown-up rituals that we have with food are a memory of how we used to like it when we were little
kids. That's how crust got a bad name.
Exactly.
It's crazy. Crust is the best part.
So if you're arranging all the M&Ms in different colors, this doesn't mean you have an OCD problem. Because, you know, I mean, you do see that sometimes with your children. You're worrying, should I be concerned that little Johnny has got all the chocolate ones there and the red ones there and the yellow ones there, and he can't eat them, you know, unless they're in that order. We don't have to necessarily go to the therapist to discuss that.
My guess is if he's doing it for 5 minutes and then eating them, you're probably fine. If he does it for 5 days, you probably might have a problem.
But the phones are lighting up. I think we're not the only ones with food rituals here, Marjorie.
877-301-8970. Let's take a call, Emily.
All right. Let's go to Kurt from Hudson.
Hi there.
Hey,
hi,
Kurt.
Hi, Kurt. What's your deal?
I love to eat burgers around the edge because you capture all the stuff as it's starting to fall out, and then your fingers, as they go around, keep all the really good stuff in the middle. So the last bite is always the best one because you've eaten around the edges of the burger, and everything, the pickle, everything that's in the center is still there at the last bite. It really works.
That's a good one.
Do you do that in public, Kurt, when you go to a restaurant?
All the time.
Really?
I never even thought about it until a girlfriend mentioned it once. She was like, you know, why do you do that?
I was going to ask if you do that on first dates.
Did you get her into it?
No. Nobody else has picked it up for me, actually. It's kind of weird.
Well, that's a good – thank you for the call, Kurt. That reminds me of something I would only do in private. You know, if I'm eating – I might do it with my kids, but I would never do it out in public. If you have turkey and mashed potatoes and – peas and gravy, and I kind of mash them all together in this big thing in the middle of my plate and eat it that way, it tastes better. But that's sort of embarrassing to do in public. Do you have any rituals that you do that in the privacy of your own home you wouldn't do in public, Michael Norton?
Food related or in general?
Well, I mean, if you'd like to make any confessions here, we're ready to hear them. But we were speaking about food.
I am not a huge ritualistic person, actually, although I do, mainly because it's because I'm a terrible cook, but I do have one dish that I make that I have a special system of timing it exactly right. So the water has to boil for this long, and then the pasta has to be in for exactly this long. And when other people make it, and we often see this is how you know something's a ritual, if other people make it in kind of the same way, but maybe they do something for a little bit shorter or a little bit longer, it really ruins it for you. And that's how you know you have a ritual. If you're bugged by the way someone's making a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, you've got a ritual in the way you make them, and you can identify them in yourself.
So your thing is al dente pasta. It has to be a certain – okay.
Exactly.
Okay. I like that.
877-301-8970. Let's go to Jennifer from Cambridge. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi. Great fan of the show. I mean, I'm a fan of your great show.
Thank you.
My husband, I try to be polite about it, but it drives me nuts when he stands in the middle of the kitchen and just pops the chocolate-covered almonds into his mouth while looking at the TV. And he argues that that's no different than when I put them in this one little square dish that I have and sit down and eat them like mouse. Not that I'm a, you know, modest eater, but I think it makes it more enjoyable and makes it less likely that I'm going to overeat.
Yeah.
And he argues that's ridiculous. It's no different. They're both going in your face, and what difference does it make?
What do you think, Michael?
Well, one is a lot more casual, for sure.
I think that's right. There is a way of thinking about rituals as helping you with portion control in some sense, where you the longer you take to eat something, the less of it you're likely to eat. And so you may be on a good strategy where even though it might seem like a waste of time to your husband that you take it from one container and put it in another container and then eat it, you're probably helping yourself eat less, whereas your husband standing and taking handfuls and eating it down might actually be helping him to overeat.
We have a sarcastic email from Stephen, but I'm going to read it because it's kind of funny.
What does he say?
He says he has a ritual of voting for nanny state elected officials before eating low-fat, low-salt, sugar-free foods, although it doesn't seem to help. I presume that might be a reference to the mayor of New York City who's trying to guard all the way we eat everything.
Well, we've had a few of those here, too.
Yeah, we've had a few of those here, too.
All right, calls are coming in here. Let's see. How about Mike from Milford? You there, Mike?
Hello?
Go ahead.
I get picked on a lot because I eat one thing at a time.
So like, you have a whole plate.
That's weird, but yeah.
Like a turkey, a Thanksgiving dinner, you'll eat the turkey and then the squash and then the mash.
Right.
In everything or just a certain thing? I mean, give us an example here.
Most everything. Yeah, most everything.
So you eat all the peas before you move on to the meat?
Yeah, if you have, French fries with a, with something, I have the fries first and then the sandwich or, like you said, at Thanksgiving dinner, that kind of a thing. It just, I'm ordered, I guess, in my thoughts.
Yeah. Mike,
makes sense to me.
Mike, if the things touch each other, does even that upset you? Or can they touch each other but you still have to eat them separately?
It used to when I was a kid. They could not touch. I've gotten better with that.
Good question.
Because you've had some personal growth over your life. They can touch, but you can't eat them together yet.
Yeah. Now, Michael,
yeah.
Do you feel this has caused a problem in your life?
No.
Or do you feel this
doesn't bother me at all.
It doesn't bother you at all. How about your family or your spouse or whatever?
No, people just pick on me or not.
Okay. Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, I would not do this, some of these things. I mean, if I went out and ordered 2 eggs over easy and they came back and one of them, the yolk was punctured, I would not send it back and demand. But at home, I will. Because I would be embarrassed in public. How about you, Emily? Would you do? I mean, some of these things seem a little weird to do out at a restaurant or with friends.
Well, it depends on what it is. I mean, I think a lot of things people don't really notice. Like, although Michael's thing, I think I would notice if somebody ate.
Yeah, I would.
All the French fries first. But I think a lot of these things, like the way you cut things, the way you cut meat, the way if it's a steak, what part of it do you eat first? I think. You know it in mm-hmm. your head, but I think it would go largely unnoticed by table mates.
Is it a ritual to spear the peas with the fork? Or
do
not?
Do you have to do that in order to enjoy them, or do you like to do it?
Well, don't want to leave them. It's hard to capture them, You can spear them, or you can kind of push them onto your fork with your knife. I'm not sure what Miss Manners says about the exact correct way to do it. I'm not sure. But, I like peas. I want to get them all, especially if they got tons of butter and salt on them.
But that's kind of different, isn't it? Manners and protocol versus ritual. And I agree that sometimes they kind of cross over, because one ritual can actually be sort of obnoxious habit that could be upsetting to other people.
Yeah, okay. So the reason you're doing this is to help people with their weight control or with their whatever. Why are you doing this? What is the purpose going to be used for?
I think two things. One is just helping us enjoy what we eat more, mm-hmm. which I think is a lot of the research that we do on happiness is really trying to think of ways that people can be happier in their everyday lives, whether it's with food or friends or whatever, how you live, can you make the same thing happier from day to day? But you're absolutely right. The other thing with food in particular is, can we help people by having them engage in rituals, which are fun and interesting, maybe slow down how quickly they eat, mm-hmm. maybe help them enjoy their food more. And now we're really looking to see, can we help them start to eat healthier, as we talked about, if we make the boring food more interesting, and then you're more likely to come back and have more of it.
The number's 877-301-8970. Take some calls here.
Yeah, let's go to Judith and Newton because she's kind of buying right into what we're talking about here. Go ahead, Judith.
Hi. Well, first thing is that the French, who know more about food than anybody, have an expression, first you eat with your eyes. And I think they totally know what they're talking about. For example, when you buy cheese or meat at a deli counter, if you have it sliced thin, it tastes a whole lot better, even if you eat the same amount. And when you look at the pre-sliced piles, that's just totally disgusting when they pick up a bunch of that. But if it's individually sliced and wrapped, it's just more appealing.
That is true. I don't like to see big slabs of things. That's a great point, don't you mm-hmm. think? Don't you get things thinly sliced at the deli?
Yeah, thinly sliced.
Yeah, and then you feel like it lasts longer.
Yeah.
Well, they don't like you. I mean, they like you to buy the pre-slice because it saves them time, and they don't like you to ask to have it customized. But I do it anyway because I know the cheese, for example, is going to taste a whole lot better.
That's right. You can't let these deli people get work their way
around. Most of them do it right.
You have to put your foot down. Thank you for the call.
Yeah, good one.
You have to go up. Well, Whole Foods. I mean, if you go to Whole Foods because you're into the non-preserved meat, you can get the stuff that's hanging on the shelves in the plastic, which, you know, is totally unappealing to me. Or you can go and wait. And they are really slow. You can go and
they are slow.
But you can go and wait 10 minutes or, you know, to get the
make your order and then you disappear and come back and get it.
Now, here's a good question. This is emailed in. Your guess, that would be Michael Norton, of course. Has research that shows ritual makes food more tasty. I want to know how to leverage this with kids who are non-compliant with green food. And also address the problem of when a child's food ritual crosses the threshold of playing with your food. Good questions.
There, actually, the last caller made me think about, there's a recent book, and I've forgotten. I'm pretty sure it's called it's either Why French People Eat Anything or Why French Children Eat Anything. But either way, a bunch of the book is about kids, and it is the case, in fact, that in France, children eat more vegetables than in the United States.
They do?
And there's probably lots of...
They know how to cook them.
Well, that's actually part of what the book is about, is that the... French do have more elaborate kind of cooking rituals and serving rituals, and maybe kids get a little bit confused about what's the fun food if everything seems fun, and they might actually eat more leafy greens and the things that we really want them to eat. So I think cross-culturally, if you think about what are the cultures that seem to be better at getting kids to eat the good stuff than other cultures, maybe we can learn something from how they get it done.
I know you got to get going, Michael, in a minute, but we've got to take this one call because this is a ritual. All right. Katia, I think it is. Boston, go ahead.
Hi, this is Katia. So, I was calling to say I eat my food, round food, like M&Ms or blueberries, in even numbers. So I'll put one on one side of my mouth, one on the other.
I think I do that, too.
Okay, Katia.
I'm glad I'm not alone, Emily.
Yeah, I think I do that.
Now, have you found this to be a problem in your life, Katia, or is it okay?
Say that again?
Has this been a problem for you, or is this okay?
No, it's okay. I can adjust in normal life, but I do it.
What do you do if you've got only one M&M left? You throw it out?
I bite it in half.
Oh, she had the answer.
I love that.
I love that.
Connie, thank you for the call. Micah, though, the email I was getting at this point, and maybe there is a ritual about this, about can you make a ritual around broccoli? Can you make a ritual around green beans to make little kids excited about eating them?
I think you can. And in fact, if you think about the ways that parents try to get kids to eat vegetables now, they often do turn it into something else. You know, so the plane coming in for a landing is, of course, the most classic one, and the kid opens his mouth and you try to get the lima beans in there. Mm-hmm. So we are thinking about ways to have more effective rituals for parents to get their kids involved with the green beans, and then suddenly the kid finds themselves liking them more.
Yeah, the broccoli, the tree. That's always – it's a little tree, and here's the tree. Yes. It's going to make you very healthy. And the other thing is you really can't dunk your cookies or your donuts in public either, I don't think. Although
yes, you can.
You can? You go to someone's house for dessert and dunk your cookie in your coffee?
I would.
I can't say
I've done it recently, but I would.
Do you do that, Michael?
I don't have any friends, so I never had that experience. Sounds great.
All right.
Okay, can we squeeze in one more call here before you go? Amy from Little Compton. Go ahead, Amy.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
I had a question. We all were talking about, cutting the crust off or eating the crust first or eating the gooey center of the grilled cheese first. And I was just wondering if you had studied at all what it means of, having the good stuff first or putting it off for last.
That's a good one.
Yes, there's actually very interesting research. So the phrase to remember is the peak end rule. And what that means is if you have some experience in your life, and then a week later, I ask you, how much did you like that experience? What you will remember is the very best moment and the very last moment of that experience, and you forget almost everything else. So it's really, really important when you're eating to try to get an amazing moment and also to end on a high note. So people who do, in fact, save the best bite for last are making a wise decision because you remember the last bite often more than any of the other bites that you eat. And if I ask you a week later, how was that meal? If you end on a sour note, you'll think the meal wasn't great. Mm. But if you end on a high note, you'll think it was.
On the other hand, there's nothing better than the first sip of a gin and tonic.
That's right. That's absolutely right. Or a martini, depending on your preference. So, Michael, one last thing. You have written Happy Money, The Science of Smarter Spending, and you were in here talking to us about it, and it was great stuff. You're studying happiness in many different ways. So on a scale of 1 to 10, Michael, how's it going for you?
Right now or in general?
In general.
I would say I'm probably an 8 or a 9. Oh, I'm a pretty happy guy.
Ah, oh,
that's darn good.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. Well, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank
Michael
you.
Norton, associate professor at the Harvard Business School, as Marjorie just said, co-author of Happy Money. Michael Norton, thanks for being here. All right, now we're going to continue the human behavior conversation with anthropologist Natasha Schull. For 20 years, she's been studying gambling addiction. With casinos coming to Massachusetts, what can we learn from her research? That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Boston Public Radio. Bringing casinos to Massachusetts has become a sticking point in the Boston mayor's race. Former Attorney General Scott Harshbarger aims to repeal casinos through a 2014 ballot initiative, and gambling addictions have been one of many concerns that casino opponents are concerned about and upset with. Hearing us with us in the studio is someone who has spent 20 years studying gambling addiction and the deliberate roles casinos play in hooking gamblers and making them addicted. Natasha Schull is a cultural anthropologist and associate professor at MIT. Her new book is Addiction by Design. Natasha, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Natasha, I think the most important and impressive part of this project for me was that you actually spent 15 years in Las
Vegas.
How could you do that?
I
couldn't
I didn't
do it for 15
actually
minutes.
Spend the whole 15 years doing this project. Or I lived for 2 years in Las Vegas, but visited a lot more than that. The project unfolded over many stages, and I really got to see some key transformations in the gambling industry and specifically in the design of slot machines.
That's really your specialty. So. Mm-hmm. This comes as no surprise to anybody that casinos earn 80% of their revenue off of slot machines. It's just that mindless. And now it's even gotten more mindless because you're just touching – you're not even pulling arms anymore, right? So what is it that you discovered about, A, why people do that? What's the satisfaction level? It's so passive.
Yeah, you know, one of the big stumbling blocks in our thinking around this activity and why people do it is the idea that people who are really hooked to gambling are doing it because they want to win, that they want that sort of thrill or euphoria of the big win. And it took me a while, actually, in talking to gamblers over a couple years to really have it sink in that they're not there to win. They're there to stay in what gambling addicts, at least, call the zone, which isn't you know, the gambling industry has this term time on device players, and that's really their target audience, not the players who are there to win big and leave with the jackpot, but players who want to sit for a really long time, sometimes playing just pennies. This is called profit from volume, another industry term,
or
Costco gambling.
Pennies?
Pennies are the most profitable machines in the country. Now, if you were to ask them, you know, these designers about 10, 20 years ago, were we going to see nickel machines, penny machines? They would have laughed because they thought we're going to go to dollar machines, $5 machines. But new technology has allowed us to go back to the nickel, back to the penny, and make even more because people are playing them longer and they're betting more pennies per hand.
We're talking with Natasha Schull, who spent 15 years in and out of Vegas, not there the whole time. But you tell the story of this woman named Molly. Mm-hmm. Tell our listeners what her deal was.
Well, Molly, one of the many gamblers that I became close to and interviewed over my years in Las Vegas, she had started out playing live games. Then she discovered video poker. And this was way back in the late 1980s. And she started out just playing single, straight-up video poker. Then a few years later, triple poker was introduced. She went to triple poker. Couldn't imagine going back to single poker. I'm not sure what game she plays today, but she this is her whole life is playing this game, video poker.
What do you mean? Does she make money off of? Does she, is what she does for a living? Because I have someone, an acquaintance who makes a living doing that.
You know, there's very few people out there. It is possible to make money off video poker, but it's not from playing video poker well. You've got to play perfectly, but the way your edge is scouring the newspapers, who has the best bonus deals at the casino, you know, some special that's running for 2 days. And you go in with a whole team and you play as much as possible to win those bonuses.
But get back to this woman. What do you mean it's her whole life? She's in there for 8 hours, 12 hours. I mean, does she have a family? What's her deal?
This
does she
woman,
have a job?
This woman worked at a casino.
Yep.
So she spent all her days booking room reservations, et cetera. Then she would get in her car and drive home. She'd go to a gas station. She drew me a little map. She said, here's where I pump my gas. And while I'm pumping my gas, I might stay a couple hours and play the machines in the gas station. Because in Vegas, they're everywhere.
In the gas station.
Then she'd go get her groceries on the way home. Now, almost all supermarkets, except for one chain with a couple of stores, have slot machines in Las Vegas. And they're not tucked in the back, you know, behind the milk. They're right in the front. On either side when you walk in, there's corridors of these machines. So she'd go get her groceries, and on the way in or out, she'd end up at the machines. You know, her whole life was this circuit.
How much money would she be spending at the gas station or at the grocery store?
Well, again, people focus so much on the money. How much money are people losing? That's, of course, really important. But think about the time.
Yeah.
I think we focus too much on the money. And how to control that. You know, is it people say, oh, maybe we can fix this by, you know, just go play handheld video poker in your room. Is that okay? We want someone in their room for 24 hours playing this game.
Well, so, no, we don't. But what was her deal, though? Was she falling apart? Was she holding her life together? Was she just some zombie-like person that was in front?
This was her way. She had a lot going on in her life. And this was her way of kind of modulating her mood. You could say that all of us have glimpses into this, not as extreme, but, you know, on the way home we're checking our email, we're doing some little texts, we're looking compulsively through photographs, we're playing music, right, to modulate our mood. We're sort of always in touch. Some people lie in bed at night and they're going through their Facebook, looking at it. So I personally feel that we all can glimpse the zone, even though this behavior of people spending weekends at the machine, you say that's so bizarre and weird, these people really have a problem. But I think we can all glimpse why they might be doing that. It's a way to escape, right? You can escape your worries, the pressures, the demands.
Right.
And it gives you this flow. So you're just doing the next thing and the next thing and the next thing. And you kind of get caught in that, and it blots out everything else.
Well, getting back to your specialty here, because your book is Addiction by Design. You talk about the algorithm behind these slot machines, and you say it cuts across class, race, gender. It's a homogenization effect. So everybody is the same, which is not true, you say, with blackjack and craps and those kind of things. But what is it about the slots that does that?
Well, yeah, I was really struck by that because I'm an anthropologist and I'm sort of have a sociological mentality. And I thought, how is race and class and gender going to show up differently with these machines? And I would, in the morning, I'd go interview someone in a trailer park with five kids, single mother on food stamps. Then at the end of the day, I'd go across town to this rich suburb of Summerlin and interview some man who's a CEO of some company. And later, a couple months later, I'd be transcribing those interviews and I'd get mixed up and I'd have to flip back to the front to remember who's speaking here. Is it the CEO in Summerlin or is it the single mom on welfare? Because the way they described this zone and what it was actually like sitting in front of those machines, the hypnotic pull of it, was so identical. So you've asked what that is. It can boil down to three factors. It's solitary. You're doing this alone. There's no interruptions, cues from people sitting around you. It's your own pace. It's continuous. There is no interruption at all. And the designers of these machines are very mindful. How can we reduce any kind of interruption? And it's rapid. These penny machines I'm talking about, the newer video slots, you're playing 1,200 hands an hour. So, you know, people are always talking about responsible gambling and that we should be rational consumers and learn about probability. Who is making rational decisions when they're playing 1,200 hands an hour?
Now, this to me is just horrifying. I mean, maybe I'm being naive here. But anyway, let's reintroduce you. Natasha Schull, cultural anthropologist, associate professor at MIT. Her new book is Addiction by Design. You also talk about the ergonomically correct seats and all those things that keep you comfortable, we presume. And then, of course, the thing you always hear about Vegas is that they're running around with the cocktails nonstop, so you never have to get up.
Right. So what I do in my book, just to break all these pieces of the puzzle down, is I start by looking at interior design and architecture, and it turns out that that's heavily geared around these machines, which are the big profit drivers of the property. Where to locate them? How do you curve the carpet? How do you control what's called casino atmospherics, which could be anything from lighting to audio kind of visuals, etc.?
How do you?
Well, you want to bring the people have figured out that you don't want people to be sitting with this giant, like, cathedral roof above them feeling all alone and exposed, because they're very aware of themselves in the world. What you want to do is you want to bring the ceilings down to create shelter and enclosure and a cocoon. And these are words, these are not my words, these are words that you find in the managed casino management literature. That's just one example. People like to gravitate to cozy little nests where they can disappear and get into their own. The casinos don't call it zone always. They call it your own little playing, private playing world, and just kind of check out. So that's what the built environment is doing. And then you look at the hardware. So the seats are ergonomically designed, very close attention to cutting off circulation, especially with the elderly. How can you sit there longer? Again, no interruptions.
Designed against cutting off circulation. So they can stay comfortable for longer.
So you can stay longer and be comfortable. And what is the height of your hand to the button so that you can just really rest your hand and all you've got to do is press your finger. You mentioned before there's no levers. That's part of the reason why.
So fast.
Right. And you will still see levers, but they have a new name. They're called legacy levers. And they're really just there as
those
a nostalgic
are these, the
icon.
We used to call them the one-armed bandits that you would pull down like that. Those are pretty
much
gone.
Today they're more like no-armed
I just want to get into the addiction part of this for a second. I mean, here we are about to launch, you know, maybe three casinos here in Massachusetts. And, you know, it's a big debate about putting aside some of the profits for addiction help and all that. And that's nothing better than creating the problem and then solving it. But are these real addictions? Is mindlessly playing the slot machine an addiction? Is that something we need to worry about? Do we have to intervene if that person gets – if that's the way – people have other obsessions they do. And if they can afford it and they're not hurting anybody, is it really a problem?
I and most sophisticated addiction researchers I know don't see addiction as this completely separate category where some people have it, you know, have that gene, and the rest of us can just go about our business. We can, you know, shoot heroin, play the slots for 20 hours, and we won't get addicted.
Smoke one cigarette.
Right. I see it as addiction is a relationship between a person and an activity or a substance, and it develops over time. And it's on a spectrum, right? You've got people who are real, and the people in my book, many of them, they're real outliers. They're pretty extreme. But again, I think they point to things that any person who's going to be sitting exposed, it's about exposure, right? How often are you playing? How long are you playing? Then you do have more chances of getting hooked in. I think addiction's a very human thing, and we're gonna see it here.
Our number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. You've been listening to Natasha now for about 5 or 6 minutes. This is pretty horrifying information to me. I wonder what your reaction is to it, especially since we are now about to open three casinos and one slot parlor right here in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. And all the casinos are going to have the slot parlors in them, too. 877-301-8970 if you'd like to call Natasha, author of Addiction by Design. Now, you have been on 60 Minutes with your research. You have been testifying before the Massachusetts legislature, about this. And you've gone to Gambling Anonymous meetings. I mean, what do you think about opening casinos? I mean, you're in a unique position to have an opinion. Do you have one?
I actually see it as a consumer protection issue, and that's where I was going with saying that addiction is on a spectrum. So it's really not the way that the casino industry mindfully tries to frame this debate is that this is about a few poor souls, and we should be good philanthropists and fund research on their genetics and biology, et cetera. That totally deflects attention away from the product.
Right.
If addiction is really a relationship between a person and a device or a substance, you have to look at that side of the relationship. And I really see my work as trying to get people to understand how these machines are designed and how they might accelerate or contribute to addiction. Then the next question you can ask is how that might be regulated. And currently, there's given the effects these machines have on people, that you're playing 1,200 hands an hour, it's not like going and buying a pair of shoes or a movie ticket. It's not a one-off deal.
Right.
This is pretty intensely affecting people, and that aspect of it isn't being regulated at all. So I really think there needs to be some consumer protection conversation around these devices.
But the problem is that, you know, the legislature makes these decisions, and presumably – and they had this one legislator, Stanley Rosenberg, traveled all over the country looking at this and looking at that issue, too. They went ahead and decided that given all these considerations, we're going to have casinos anyway. My attitude is too bad if you've got an addiction problem. If you're going to go into the casino and you want to do that, why should it be everybody else's problem? Why should we be setting aside and having consumer regulation and this and that? We have agreed that this is legal, like drinking or smoking or whatever. Now it's your problem. Why should it be everybody else's?
Well, that's obviously one approach that could be extended to many things, and it's certainly not the approach I take or many other people, that we should have this free market free-for-all where, you know, people who get exposed to things can get so hooked into them. That's going to trickle back, not trickle down, but trickle back up, right? And this is going to be devastating for families, for employers. There will be embezzlements. There will be so many negative effects on all of us. You could see it that way.
Yeah, and it will cost a lot. But we voted to make them
legal.
We did.
Right. And I should say that I just yesterday went and had a session with the commission.
The Gaming Commission.
The Gaming Commission.
You testified before the Gaming Commission yesterday.
Right.
What did they think of all this?
It's really unique here in Massachusetts because you say, you know, we voted this in, let's make it happen. But it was voted in with some unprecedented measures for research and for regulation. So like in other things, you might not agree with them, but like in healthcare, Massachusetts kind of pioneered other kinds of systems. And I think it has the opportunity right now to do that with the way that casinos are brought here. And these commissioners, they realize that their task is to help this business flourish, because why else would we bring it if it's not going to help? You know, mm-hmm. We have to make it work.
Right.
But let's do so in a way that doesn't harm people. And they're really being mindful about that. What kind of regulations make sense so that it won't hurt, or you could say tax everybody, but will protect many who might be drawn problematically become involved with
these
machines.
But can you regulate the industry? Because as you say, and as you write in your book, this is an industry that their intent is to addict you.
I do not actually say. I want to clarify, because that's how I was introduced.
No, I'm saying that.
Well, you're saying that their intention is
sure.
to addict. I don't think so.
Or
I think their intention is to make money.
Make you sit there.
Yeah. And it's a kind of collateral. This is addiction as a sort of collateral damage. They're like other businesses, right? There's really no difference. They're not uniquely sinister in the gambling industry. So that's why, again, I feel like regulation is the only answer. We're not going to.
You know what I wonder? You hear about this addictive person. I mean, I've read that you're more likely to become an addicted gambler if you're within 50 miles of a casino, which makes sense because you were introduced to this and you go down there and start doing it. But I wonder if it's like a lot of other things. There are some people who just get sucked in, and some people who at some point, maybe after their second hour in front of the slot machines, would say, "This is nuts. I'm leaving." Are there two types of people, the addicts and the non-addicts, that crosses different from whether it's alcohol or whether it's gambling or whether it's smoking or not?
Again, I don't see any strict division. This is people we're talking about.
Yeah.
And if you look at it just for a moment, let's look at addiction in general.
Yeah.
What are the sources of addiction? It's to pleasure, to food, to sex, all things related to our survival. Right. We're all wired to do these things. Some people are more vulnerable than others, of course. By the same token, certain products, substances, and devices in this case are more wired to hook people in. And shouldn't we try to be mindful about how they're hooking and how we might kind of reel back the harmful effects of that?
So you have no opinion one way or the other about whether we should be opening gambling casinos in Massachusetts.
You're trying to nail it down.
Oh, no. I was on the anti side,
yeah,
right?
Sure.
I mean, I was brought in to testify against.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
Now, that said, I spend a lot of time in casinos, not only for research, but because my husband loves playing live poker.
Oh, well, now, is that on the slot machine or is that?
No. Live poker is around a table.
Around a table. Well, that's a game.
Which
yeah.
is very different, as yeah. you point out. Blackjack, poker, baccarat, whatever
right.
you pronounce
people
that.
Lumped it, and I would always start off my testimony in front of the legislature saying, you know, you're lumping gambling yeah. in together. You can't really call this all gambling. You've got to separate it out. And a card, you know, poker, for instance, you don't even play against the house. This is a game of skill. You're
game
playing
of skill.
Against other people. The house is taking a little rent, a little rake. But that's not their moneymaker. And even a game like craps, certainly you can become addicted to these things. But research has consistently shown, replicated studies coming out of Rhode Island, for instance, that it takes only 1 year of playing of intense slot play to become addicted. It takes 3 to 5 years if you're doing sports, the racetrack, or cards. So clearly on the spectrum of potency, the machines are the most addictive and troublesome, and I don't think they should be all lumped in. I'm not anti-casino. I'm not yeah. anti-games.
Well, we are talking
play
about
poker.
The one single slot parlor here in Massachusetts. Yeah. So I assume you don't think much of slot parlors.
I don't think much of slot barns would be the
okay. that would
be the term.
Well, I'm
that
with
they're
you,
called.
Natasha, but. I wouldn't have voted for him either.
Right.
I would have been voted against him. But once we got him,
here's
I say
the,
it's
here's
your
the
problem.
Thing, though. Let me just point out
Lock
that,
yourselves
that,
out.
That Deval Patrick, when he started this, he was very against slot barns.
I know.
He's like, over my dead body and destination resort. And this is another neat division that gets made, right? Like, we've got our slot barns and then this totally different thing called the destination resort. In the end, destination resorts are also slot barns. They're also making most of their money off of that when you look at the gaming revenue. Of course, it's different. There's restaurants. There's other games.
Yep.
You could say that they're better than just purely this big barn of slots. But let's not kid ourselves that all casinos are slot barns today.
All right. Natasha Scholl, thanks so much. Cultural anthropologist and associate professor at MIT. Her new book is Addiction by Design. Thanks, Natasha.
Thank you, guys.
All right. When we come back, it's excuse me, time for Open Mic with Brian McGrory. This is Boston Public Radio on 89.7 WGBH.
Is every Wednesday at 1 o'clock is the editor of the Boston Globe, Brian McGrory. Hi, Brian.
Hello, Marjorie. How are you?
I'm fine. And Jim Browdy is very, very sad that he couldn't be here today because he's very fond of you, Brian.
I'm trying to picture where Jim goes on vacation. Where would that be?
I think he can't reveal it. It's a big secret.
Why do I have him pictured in a yoga class right now, or Pilates at Canyon Ranch in the Berkshires?
How did you know?
Eating a fruit plate as a snack before a steamed halibut for dinner. You know,
absolutely. I think of him as a spandex kind of guy.
Yeah,
Brian.
Yeah.
So I'm dying to know. You know, Whitey Bulger. Of course, we had the verdict on Monday, guilty on not all the murders, but most of the murders and everything else. But, you know, Brian, the jurors, the couple that have talked, mentioned how disgusted they were by the FBI corruption, and the families of the murder were disgusted by the FBI corruption. We had yesterday the former head of the state police, Colonel Foley, in here, saying he's not sure there are systems in place to prevent this kind of FBI corruption going forward. So is this it for the FBI? Are they kind of off the hook, or should we in the media be looking further into what exactly went on during all these years that Whitey Bulger was running roughshod over South Boston and beyond?
I mean, in that regard, doesn't it feel like a little bit of a letdown in this trial? I mean,
yes.
We're all anticipating that this trial would reveal, you know, in more vivid fashion and perhaps in greater scope, the level of corruption on the part of the federal government, both here and in Washington. And while we certainly saw basically what we already knew, we didn't get a whole lot newer, a whole lot more depth. And that part of it is a bit of a letdown. I mean, look, at the reality is Mark Wolf, the U.S. District Court judge, did extraordinary work when he exposed the relationships back when he did that. And, we can remain vigilant. We can continue to look at this. I'm not sure right now what else we will get, but
yep.
I know that we are. Shelley Murphy's as good a reporter as there is out there.
Great reporter. And her book with Kevin Cullen is terrific.
Oh, thank you. And I don't know why I said thanks. I didn't write it, but I.
Well, they're your reporters, and they did it. They did it. They did it great. And for that matter, so did the former Dick Lehr and
Jerry O'Neill. Also
both
had a
books.
Fantastic book.
Yep.
So Shelley is still looking into this. Kevin Cullen will always be looking into this. So, you know, we are continuing to be vigilant, and we'll see where it goes.
How do you think, you know, a lot of people that aren't in the business wonder how you gauge interest in this? Because there was a lot of talk, Brian, at the beginning, oh, this is old ancient history. This is old Boston. Whitey Bulger is 83 years old. South Boston is totally different. But how do you gauge the interest in this and decide how much to play the Whitey Bulger story? I mean, it's over now, but you still have stories in about the jurors and stuff today.
Well, it was pretty easy for us because, and I'm sure you have access to it as well, we can see on our two websites, Boston.com and BostonGlobe.com, what people are reading. And I get a list overnight every night of how many people read what story online that day. And I will tell you, you're absolutely right. There was a lot of fear that only, older reporters like
me,
and to a lesser extent you.
oh, you're so kind, Brian.
This was a big deal in our heads, but it wasn't a big deal in the collective mind of Boston anymore. That's wrong. These stories were just eaten up by the reading public. They couldn't get enough of it.
And really?
I think, you know, if I'm trying to analyze why that is, I think it's because, you know, Whitey Bulger became a legendary figure. You didn't have to live through what happened to appreciate the importance of what was going on. It was, you know, he was part folklore, part legend, and it was this trial provided a really interesting look at a Boston from not all that long ago, from the 1980s and the 1970s and even the early 90s. And I think people were really fascinated to see what it is that we used to be like here, and especially what it is, what it's like when the federal government goes completely awry, as it did in this case.
Well, you know what? I also think that it was just the enormity of the crimes. I mean, who does not want to take a gander at a guy like John Matarano, who admitted killing 20 people, probably killed many more, on the witness stand, when we've talked about this before, how I wish it had been on television, or who would not want to? I mean, these are monstrous people, and let's hope they're very, you know, unusual in the population. Who doesn't want to hear about that?
Yeah, I mean, monstrous people with utterly bizarre storylines. I mean, John Matarano walks into court a free man
yeah.
after confessing to what, 20 murders?
I know. Yeah.
He literally walked in a free man and walked out and, you know, went to wherever it is he lives.
I think he lives in Cambridge on Social Security.
I mean, just unbelievable. How do you get your head around that? How do you possibly come to terms with that? And as it was, the jury couldn't. They couldn't.
Yeah, well, again, as we know, it's not only John Monterano, but Kevin Weeks, who assisted in 5 murders and was burying bodies and pulling teeth out of bodies. He got 5 years. He didn't kill anybody, but he was in the thick of it. So it's pretty much done now, right?
It is. I mean, but to your point, just to carry it on a note further, and I thought you had a terrific column on what it all meant to victims' families.
Yeah, a lot of them were disgusted when they didn't get the justice they thought they deserved, and have the people that were killed in their families proven. The jury did not think the government proved that their particular family members. The most famous, of course, is Deborah Davis, the girlfriend of Stephen Flemmie.
Yeah.
They did not prove, according to the jury, that Whitey Bulger had killed her, and in fact seemed to believe that Stephen Flemmie had killed her. They also didn't believe much of anything John Monterano said.
Well, that's the thing, is you saw it reflected. Anything that Monterano said, the jury just said, there's no way we're going to believe that. And in the case of Deborah Davis, it was Flemmie. But you had a great column on that. I thought Kevin Cullen had a terrific column yesterday on how Boston moved on. You know, Whitey Bulger is basically a ghost that still happened to be alive on a waterfront where he used to commit murder that now is completely different. It is over now. It is over. We'll continue to look at it. We'll continue to be vigilant about anything we can learn regarding the FBI and the relationships here. But, it's time to move on to some extent.
Well, let's move on to your front page story today about Lisa Saunders, part of the family that used to own the Park Plaza Hotel and her valet parking space. Brian, please tell people about this great story.
Well, it's people are reading this thing in droves so far this morning. It's people are flocking to the website to see this. So Lisa Saunders, who seems like a very nice person, do you know her at all?
I don't know her at all.
I mean,
I know she doesn't like your reporter much. She said you had an aggressive reporter out there terrifying her on the street, Brian.
Sean Murphy, that's him. Sean Murphy, you could not be more polite, by the way. He's a very nice guy. I wouldn't want to be on his wrong side on a story, but a very nice guy. So evidently, Lisa Saunders owns that office building next to the Park Plaza. Her family used to own the Park Plaza. There used to be a valet space in front of a restaurant there that is now shuttered, a place called Pairings, where Bonfire used to be.
Mm-hmm.
And lo and behold, Lisa hires a go-to guy in City Hall, a consultant, to get that valet space moved. And the valet space is moved down the street right in front of the entrance to her office building. And from what we can tell, it's the only valet space in front of an office building in Boston, not in front of a restaurant or hotel or club.
Yeah.
And our reporter was out there and saw Lisa parking in that valet space every day for the better part of a week with meter maids just walking past, not giving tickets, no valet out there. I mean, for all practical purposes, it looked like a private space in the middle of Park Square.
For which she was paying nothing. Nothing.
Well, that's the thing, is when you contrast it, look, we said in the story, this isn't the crime of the century. It's not even probably a crime at all. But when you contrast it with what parking is selling for in the city and the frustrations that everybody goes through trying to find parking, tandem spaces up in Back Bay sold for $560,000.
I still can't get over that. $560,000 for two spaces.
How many of us have spent literally, you know, half an hour, 45 minutes, an hour circling a block looking for a space? How many of us have arrived at our car 2 minutes late after the meter expires to find a bright orange parking ticket on our windshield? So this one resonates a little bit, I think.
I think it touches people in a visceral way. You're absolutely right. Because if you do go park in a garage in Boston, I mean, you're in there for an hour in that whole neighborhood. And if people don't realize, this is right down in the heart of Boston, you know, a block or so from Boston Common and the Public Gardens. It's Park Square, you can be paying $25-$30 to park for an hour and a half.
Oh, easily.
Easily.
Yeah.
And here she is, and it is a black Cadillac, and of course, and she looks like a lovely, attractive woman. The great picture of her getting something out of the trunk on the front page of the Globe. And here she is parking in the spot for free. It reminds me a little bit of the story years ago, Brian. Remember when Mr. and Mrs. John Kerry, they live up on, I always mispronounce this, and you know, Lewisburg, Louisburg. What is it, Brian?
You can go either way.
I
think they would prefer Lewisburg.
Lewisburg, okay. Anyway, if people don't remember this, Mrs. John Kerry, Teresa Hines, and we all wish her the best because she's had some health problems lately, but it was a great story when she had a fire hydrant moved from in front of her house so she could park there. Remember that?
I do remember that. I do remember that, yes.
You know, we were after that story for days and days at the Boston Herald because, again, it's the same thing. It's this visceral thing. You spend hours looking for parking spaces over the course of your life. You probably figure you spend weeks over the course of a lifetime in Boston looking for a parking space. It really gets to people, doesn't it?
I mean, I used to, many years ago when I lived in Back Bay without a parking space, you would just kind of accept in your life that you would get home from work and it would be an hour-long ordeal just circling, finding a street space. And you would have to go to this very special place in your mind saying, it's okay, I'm just going to relax,
yeah.
I'm just going to drive around, not a big deal, you know. So, yeah, it does. I think this touches a bit of a chord.
Ever get your car booted, Brian McGroy, from the Boston
Club? Oh, God, yeah.
Me too.
Yeah.
That was always disheartening.
It's a rite of passage in this town.
So Emily Rooney is not with me today because we are, in full disclosure, pre-taping this, and she had to do something this morning. But she did take you to task a little bit on her show, Beat the Press, last Friday night. She talked about, it wasn't just the Globe, it was the Herald. Of course, people know that John Henry, the owner of the Boston Red Sox, has purchased the Boston Globe. But she wondered why there had been no letters commenting on the sale in the Globe or in the Herald. And then a couple of letters appeared on Saturday in the Globe. One was pro John Henry, one was kind of neutral, and one was just worried that the Globe was going to be all sports all the time. But Brian McGroy, inquiring minds want to know here, what's up with this? You know, you get tens of thousands of readers, and only three letters appeared on the sale. Was
I mean,
that intentional?
It's a legit question. I'm going to give you an unbelievably mealy-mouthed answer, and that is I have no idea. I don't do letters to the editor. That's over on the editorial side. Same editor, the editorial page editor who oversees our editorials, our op-eds, oversees letters to the editor, and I don't know why we haven't done more. I mean, I will say, do people... I mean, that's terrific that Emily cares about letters to the editor about the sale of the Globe, you know. But
I love letters to the editor.
Does the average reader really, are they sitting at home in Braintree or Medford saying, gee, I really, you know, need to read letters to the editor about the sale of the Globe? I mean, there's a caution flag here about us taking ourselves too seriously and devoting too much ink to ourselves. That said, we did run a couple, right?
Right.
I mean, we did.
Well, the obvious thing that people might be, and maybe I'm just more suspicious than most, Brian, thinking that this was an order from John Henry that we're not going to run letters to the editor criticizing my purchase of the Boston Globe.
Oh, God, Marjorie, come on. You know better than that. That could not be... that could not be more ludicrous.
Okay.
John Henry is not sitting over at Fenway Park telling us what we should run on our letters page. That's just not happening.
Okay. We just wanted to check that out, Brian, because, as I said, inquiring minds do want to know this. Now, one last thing. You were a correspondent for many years in Washington covering the Clinton administration.
I was.
So you know what it's like down in D.C., the whole atmosphere, you know, politics, money, all these things colliding. But Mark Leibovich, who is the chief national correspondent for the New York Times, has got this book, which I have just started, This Town, talking about things getting totally out of control down in D.C., a city of millionaires. He's got a great opening line to the prologue of his book. We all remember Tim Russert, the great correspondent that did beat the press for years. He died tragically and prematurely. Here's the opening line of Mark's book. Tim Russert is dead, but the room was alive. You can't work it too hard at a memorial service, obviously. It's the kind of thing people notice. But the big-ticket Washington departure right can be such a great networking opportunity. And he goes on to talk about the funeral of Tim Russert and Richard Holbrooke as sort of this coming together of the political power structure, the media power structure, everybody handing out business cards, everybody sort of tearing up, but not really so much for Holbrooke or for Russert, for, you know, themselves and what Russert's departure might mean to careers or what Holbrooke's departure might mean to politics. He gives this picture of a very incestuous place just populated by millionaires. Has it always been like this? Or is this an accurate portrayal of what it is in 2011?
I mean, first of all, I cannot wait to read this book. I have it.
I just started it.
I have it set aside. It's on my iPad. I cannot wait to read it. It reminds me of kind of the next generation of the great book, Game Change.
Yes. We've talked about the campaign of 2008 and was pretty depressing.
In terms of insight into Washington, you know, Washington has always been a fairly disgusting place. When I was down there I've been down there a few times now, but last time I was down there was 96 to 99, and I couldn't get out of there fast enough because, you know, from what you describe of Leibowitz's book, it is exactly that. It's people giving air kisses to each other at funerals while looking over their shoulders, looking over their, you know, their colleagues' shoulders to see who else more important they might need to talk to. And, you know, it's a place, Washington is a place that produces absolutely nothing but hot air. And so everybody has to, you know, vie for their status because they can't point to anything that they produce. And so they have to pretend they matter probably and usually more than they actually do. And it's gotten worse over the years. I mean, now all they do is fight down there. They don't actually pass any bills. There are very few major accomplishments. So, the book has gotten rave reviews. David Shribman gave it, former Globe, Washington Bureau Chief, Pulitzer Prize winner, gave it a rave review in the New York Times.
Yep.
Christopher Buckley gave it a rave review in the New York Times Book Review. I can't wait to read this book. So you're having him on today.
I'm having him on today, and I'm reading furiously from now until he comes on. But it's been compared to Tom Wolfe's Radical Chic, which was the great thing he did about the Leonard Bernstein's Party for the Black Panthers in terms of capturing a certain type of person at a certain time in American history. But the thing is, Brian, I don't know if I've asked you about this before, but you know, we've both been reporters for a long time. You're the boss now at the Globe, but it's always been difficult for me as a reporter when I spend too much time with a source or a politician and I come to like them. It's harder for me to be tough on them when I need to be tough on them. So I've always kept a big distance from politicians. How have you managed that? Because that's one of the points Leibowitz makes, that everybody's kind of in bed together and not being as tough on their sources as they should be because of this incestuous relationship.
Well, I mean, Leibowitz is exactly right in that regard. They're all going to the same cocktail
yes.
parties. They're all eating at the same restaurants. They're dependent on each other. Reporters are dependent on the politicians they cover, and politicians are dependent on the, you know, big-time reporters and columnists. So Leibowitz has it exactly right in that regard. I mean, the best reporters still know how to throw, you know, a really hard brushback pitch when they need to, and the very best reporters keep their distance. You know, it's hard to do down in Washington, but it's really important.
Yeah, okay. Well, so have you kept your distance, or have you been able to do that brushback? Seems to me you were at the Capitol Grill one time or two with a politician or two over the years. I recall in the great Brian McGrory's column in the Boston Globe, Brian.
Yeah, you know, look, there's an art, and I believe me, I don't think I've mastered it, let alone learned it, of being able to somehow get some access. It will reap information while also maintaining some independence too.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's a tough one.
We've had Deval Patrick in our studios for many years now, once a month. And, I mean, that's a classic case of a man that I think the public finds quite charming when they listen to him on the radio or they see him speak. He's a great speaker. He's a very charismatic person. It's hard because your tendency is to like this person, and then you see him do something that you don't like, and it's hard to separate yourself, I think.
Oh, I mean, for God's sakes, look at your colleague, Jim Browdy. I mean, every time Scott Brown text messages him, you've got to put like 4 fans on him because he gets all hot and bothered and you think he's going to faint.
He does. And Jim Browdy claims that he hasn't let that get in the way of his journalistic inquiries.
Oh, God, no, absolutely not. He would never let that happen.
Okay, Brian McGrory, I'll tell Jim you were asking for him today, okay? And I'll tell him that you think he did a fine job separating his bromance with Scott Brown from his political questions towards Scott Brown, okay?
I appreciate that, Marjorie. It's been a pleasure to chat with you here.
Thank you very much, Brian McGrory.
Brian joins us every Wednesday at 1 o'clock. Tune in tomorrow at 1 o'clock for Open Mic with Christopher Lydon. So we have to mention, just briefly, Emily and I, the story I just mentioned with Brian McGrory about the Lisa Saunders abusing the city-owned parking space and getting away with it.
Own personalized valet.
Yeah, her own personalized valet. If you didn't see the front page of the Globe today,
we have this shot of this woman, Lisa Saunders, and she's from the family, the Saunders family, that has owned the Park Plaza for many decades. She's taking something out of the trunk of her black Cadillac. She has her own space, or she did anyway, until the story appeared in the Globe, at 20 Park Plaza for free.
Yeah.
And Brian, as you just heard him say, people are going bananas over the story. Now, you live in the Back Bay, Emily. Why are we so hysterical about this story?
It's not just, I think anybody anywhere in America would admire this woman, this for the chutzpah. I mean, she got somebody who was well-connected. She got this guy, Greg Donovan, who's very well-connected himself.
Yep.
He goes down to City Hall. He figures out that there's this other valet parking spot that's some random space somewhere in the financial area or whatever, not being used. They figure out a way to get Knievy, I think his name is.
Michael Knievy, a very close guy with the mayor, power broker.
This no parking spot to a valet parking spot and leaving, you know, taking it away from the other spot. And then she figured, I got to admire her in some ways. I do. I think that's
you do. I think if I were on the front page of the Globe with a questionable valet parking spot, I wouldn't
feel proud
of myself. Well, you do have to. I mean, it does take chutzpah.
Wow.
It does. It's like Teresa Hines. We just said when she had the fire hydrant moved up there in Lewisburg Square,
yeah.
So she and John could park right in front of the manse. And this is the same sort of thing.
But they figured out a way. Yeah, they
figured out a way. Yeah. But I don't know that the average person would look at this and feel admiration for Lisa Saunders. Do you think?
I think everybody would have the same reaction. Wow. How'd you get that done?
I mean, in the Back Bay, and you live in the Back Bay, it is a vicious situation trying to find a place to park on the street. You can drive around, as Brian McGroy just said, for 45 minutes.
No, and
for
people
space.
Who live there, you know, they're willing to pay hundreds of thousands of dollars for an outside spot in an alley.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. $560,000 for those two parking spaces.
Tandem parking spot.
And it was a pretty dumpy tandem parking
spot,
too. I mean, you're having to climb over, you know, garbage cans
and
the occasional rodent running by you for $500,000 to get to your parking space. And they didn't even want it for themselves. They wanted it for the workmen and the occasional guest in their home.
At least they paid for it themselves. And that's the thing about this is, if she had been paying for the parking, people, well, all right. I mean, at least she paid for the spot, but nothing, free. I have to say, I think it's audacious, doesn't even begin, but figuring out a way to get your own private valet spot is pretty cool.
Okay, well, I think you should have her on Greater Boston and
I would
quiz her
come.
About how she managed to do this so the rest of us may be able to take advantage of this opportunity. Even though it's free, I bet there had to be some money exchange
for
the consultant to go up and do his business at City Hall. I don't think
we'll
he
get
did
to the bottom of that.
Of the goodness of his heart. Anyway, if you think parking privileges are a scandal, well, they pale in comparison to what goes on down in Washington, D.C. Wait till you hear some of the anecdotes from Mark Leibovich, his new book about how Washington may not do its part to serve the country, but it's done a great job, a fantastic job of serving itself. Mark Leibovich up next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Mark Leibovich is the chief national correspondent at the New York Times Magazine. And if everything you've learned about D.C. is from the West Wing or House of Cards, you need to stick around for this conversation. His new book is This Town, Two Parties and a Funeral, plus plenty of valet parking in America's gilded capital. Mark, thanks for joining us. No one was quite as clever as that woman we just talked about, that commandeering her own valet parking spot. I didn't see any of those stories in there.
There could have been. Should have looked. I could have. I'd forgotten about the fire hydrant story, though, because that's sort of kind of Washington-esque.
Uh-huh.
You could probably have that happen in Georgetown. That's a great story.
So I have to say, after reading this whole thing, and I really felt like, first of all, you brought me there, and I was one of you, and I was, like, right in the room. And suddenly I realized why this is so much fun. It's like you're a power player. You're just in the mix. You're somebody. You're important. It's like,
yeah, but you don't even have to live there too. You get to come home to Boston at the end. No,
I can see why it's so infectious.
Well, thanks. First of all, I mean it's been kind of cool because I mean I am an insider. Look,
I admit it.
I work for a major news organization. I mean I'm invited to these parties. I mean, my job is probably invited to these parties. I don't think me personally am invited to these parties, but. Yeah, I mean, this is the world I live in. I mean, I couldn't sort of pose as a foreign correspondent and just sort of like swoop in and burn down the village and leave. So, yeah, but I mean, having said that, you can't live in Washington, especially as a reporter, without having a more of a hate relationship with the place because you get so cynical and people talk to you in a certain way, and it's easy to forget that this is not reality. I mean, it's Hollywood in some ways. I mean, House of Cards is the thing that people have been talking about a lot lately. But this is not the way most Americans deal with each other. And this book was sort of an effort to bring that to life.
You start with the scenario of the Tim Russert funeral and the power brokers coming into the Kennedy Center and the funeral. It was one ceremony after another. And coverage on TV, by the way, they went for a week.
Oh, yeah.
But how people were, you know, jockeying for the best seat in the house or to... I found it almost impossible to believe that they were handing each other their cards.
Business cards.
Oh, yeah. No. There was this great scene at that funeral, which happened sort of in June of 08, which was right after Obama was about to get nominated.
Hillary dropped out.
Barack Obama was about to, you know, get nominated. McCain was about to get nominated. Everyone was sort of – there was a receiving line around David Axelrod and Robert Gibbs, basically everyone congratulating him, and I'm putting up bunny ears here. But they were trying to book Obama on their shows. They were trying to get in with what could be the next White House communications team. It was quite striking, not to mention everyone sort of competing for Tim Russert's job at his memorial service.
David Gregory.
How do you compete for the job at the memorial service?
Well, all the executives are there, and you go and you talk to them, and you grieve properly, and you grieve publicly, and there is a whole kabuki to it, which perhaps cynically, as some have accused me of, I try to describe. But no, that was a pageant. I mean, it was live television. It was, you said, for days. And it was very much a state funeral. I mean, deservedly so. I mean, Tim Russert was a giant, and there are very few people who live up to his legend. And I think Tim was someone who got close. I think that the days of coverage probably didn't do it total justice, but whatever.
Well, while we're at this scene of the Tim Russert funeral, you talk about Bill and Hillary Clinton arriving. And I naively said, because I've not been in Washington, so this was an eye-opener to me, and I was a little bit... I don't know. It didn't feel right to me. Right. But anyway, you talk about Bill and Hillary Clinton coming in, and they had, you know, she just lost.
Right.
And that they hated Russert, and Russert hated them. So I thought to myself, isn't there some level, like maybe when you've been elected president twice in a row, and everybody loves you, and she didn't win, but she's a huge celebrity, isn't there some point where you can say, you know what? I'm not going to be this big of a hypocrite because I've attained a certain stature. I'm always going to be a two-term president. Why do they have to go to this and pretend?
Well, I mean, first of all, the psyche of Bill Clinton has been the subject of all kinds of books and speculation and so forth. But I would say that, I mean, the comparison I draw in the book is to a mafia funeral.
Yes.
I mean, you have all the families coming together to pay respect. Yeah. You have the Democrats, the Republicans, the media, the hostile media, the friendly media, the money people, the hangers-on. And that was very much what that scene was like. And the Clintons are head of the Clinton family, and their tribe was just vanquished. And, you know, the Clintons are pros at death and sickness. I mean, that's what they do. Not to, again, be overly cynical, because I think that their empathy has served them well. But I thought it was one of the striking parts of the scene.
You talk about 1992 with Bill Clinton, with kind of that was the birth of celebrity operatives. If Watergate was the birth of celebrity journalists, Woodward and Bernstein, but suddenly you had people like Mary Madeline and James Carville and George Stephanopoulos bursting on. Now many of these people, like David Axelrod, David Plouffe, these people are as well known. And they get the seats on Meet the Press and all those places. How did that happen?
You're right. I mean, first of all, I mean, I think, the birth of cable, or really the boom in cable in the early 90s, sort of gave everyone a face. And it created a marketplace that didn't exist before for just people getting these big TV deals and commentator deals and so forth. That happened in conjunction with the book market sort of taking off for public servants becoming public brands, essentially. I mean, writing books, being, you know, made for TV biopic characters, just the whole celebrity aspect of politics really taking hold, which has only been exacerbated with the internet. I also think that, look, I mean, politics has become a very big business. I mean, political consulting, lobbying certainly has become – there is more money in politics now by maybe a factor of 100 than there was 20, 30 years ago, and that just keeps advancing. So it's easy to monetize your public service, and I think one of the core parts of the book is that self-service in Washington has replaced public service as really the overriding objective.
We're talking with Mark Leibovich, who just wrote this fantastic new book, This Town, Two Parties and a Funeral, plus – plenty of valet parking in America's gilded capital. Well, you just mentioned that this is problematic. And oh, by the way, if listeners want to call in and ask questions to Mark about what's going on in D.C., 877-301-8970 is the number, 877-301-8970. But is all this, you know, the celebrity culture, the millionaires that you talk about, you know, populating this place, putting them so out of touch with America, and just this sort of everybody scratching each other's back, this cannot be good for the republic here, can it?
I don't think it is. I don't think it is at all. I mean, I think what people intuitively know is that Washington is dysfunctional. Washington is disappointing. I mean, you can look at any number of national polls about how poorly Washington is performing, how poorly Congress is performing, the media, and go down the line. What I wanted to do is sort of get beyond the shorthand of Washington is dysfunctional. I wanted to tell people why they should hate Washington. I wanted to show people why. I mean, again, I'm sort of struck and actually kind of gratified by how people outside the Beltway have been, I think, rightly both entertained but disgusted by what I wrote. And because
how I felt. Entertained.
Yes, I can totally live with that. Yeah. I mean, it's a tough balance to strike. And I mean, hopefully I did it okay. But you really, really cannot be, you know, a concerned American, a concerned citizen, and respect what is going on here.
One of the things that just struck me, and you go into it in great detail with examples of people, is this living with the fact that everybody has a conflict of interest. Ugh. Andrea Mitchell and Alan Greenspan, just to name one. Tammy Haddad, who was the booker to the stars I knew when I was at one of those cables for a while. Mm-hmm. Robert Barnett, the agent to the stars, who represents 347 people or something like that, you know, robbing from Peter to pay Paul. Yeah, exactly. And these are names that we kind of know, you know, they're out there. But these people run the town.
They have made Washington work for them. I mean, again, and they are products of a marketplace and a machine. I mean, they are products of a lot of money. I mean, Tammy Haddad, who was basically kind of a glorified party.
She was the original booker for Larry King.
She was the booker for Larry King.
Okay. But she took off after that.
She did. I mean, she's kind of a star bleeper.
Yeah.
She loves being around famous people. She loves just sort of being in the room, putting parties together, just being someone.
She holds an annual White House correspondence dinner brunch,
which is just the mask of the Red Death, which it's really. I'm thankfully, thanks to this book, I'm blacklisted from it,
sure.
So I don't.
Yeah,
get to
I was going
to
ask you that.
Oh
no
more brunches for me.
No
that,
more
this
brunches.
Is fine. Well, not this brunch in particular, because I think Tammy was agreed.
She came off fine.
That's what I would have thought, but I don't think I've heard secondhand that she didn't like it. But anyway, Tammy is now a businesswoman. Tammy is paid hundreds of thousands of dollars a year by media corp companies to help, in which she will throw parties for them, will get their sort of brand out there, will get them access to the White House. I mean, to me, that is the biggest, I mean, reveal here. I mean, the Obama administration was supposedly against the traditional influence peddlers of lobbyists or fixers like the old school sort of Clinton days. I mean, Tammy Haddad essentially helped like Newsweek land an interview with the president of the United States just by working her contacts and working all the people that she's raised money for. I mean, that's one of, I think, the kernels in there that people didn't fully know about. But to answer your question, Marjorie, what's been interesting about the response in town in D.C. has been the sort of how dare you tenor.
How
of
dare
it.
You?
How dare me?
Okay.
Meaning that
Mark
how does Leibovich. An insider? How does an insider write critically about other insiders? This is against the unspoken rules. And look, I'm a journalist. I abide by ground rules. I abide by every rule that all of our professions would hold dear. But there is this club that I describe, and I was part of it. I think I still probably am by virtue of working for a news organization, but I don't care, frankly. I think that this is a story that needed to be written.
Well, you talk about, and then we should talk about the things that you say, the lobbying and so forth that has changed, and cable and all that has changed Washington. But you sort of have this, the two funeral thing. Mm-hmm. So we've talked about the Tim Russert funeral. Tell people now about the Richard Holbrook funeral. And, of course, he was for years with the State Department. Died
married to Peter Jennings' ex-wife.
Married to Cathy Martin.
Yes, that's right. And you worked for Peter Jennings. You're part of this little club, too.
I
know
all these
Rooney.
People. I knew all these
yeah,
people.
You knew all these people. You're
it's
guilty
fine.
Over there, Emily.
We're all
no,
guilty.
I lived in New York.
So what about tell people about the Richard Holbrook
Well, Richard Holbrook was actually great. I mean, he was the quintessential Washingtonian in that he worked it. He was
he
always
did.
Just fiercely, just like, he cared deeply. What does the president think of me? He was the special envoy for Afghanistan and Pakistan for Hillary Clinton, who was basically his patron in the Obama administration. President Obama could not stand him. President Obama's team could not stand him. They thought he was just the kind of prima donna, full of himself, kind of guy that they had no use for. And again, he died just a little later than the prime of his life. He was in his late 60s. I guess it was late in 2010. And that funeral, also at the Kennedy Center. It's interesting that these two funerals occurred at the Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts. Okay.
nice
I mean,
symbol.
This is, I mean, you know, and the deities are everyone performing, right? But there were 15 eulogists, including Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton and all these people who are no strangers to motorcades. And again, it was this great Washington pageant in which the Clinton Washington and the Obama Washington were sort of sniping at each other. And there was this great sort of political allegory taking place sort of in these sort of ostensibly mournful environments. But no, Richard Holbrook, again, he despised Washington. He was very, very proud to be a New Yorker. He was very, very proud to go home at the end of the week, fly back to his apartment on the Upper West Side, take his dog tags off. Everyone wears these pictures of themselves around their necks in Washington. He said, Washington's the only city in the United States where people need pictures of themselves to remember who they are. And that was like his line. So anyway, yeah, he was a classic character also.
But they were faking it, and everybody was faking it at this funeral, and Barack Obama was disgusted by the whole thing. How could you tell he was disgusted by the whole thing?
Body language. His speech was completely pro forma. I mean, it was one of the most blah speeches of his presidency. I mean, he didn't like the guy. I mean, Barack Obama is not a terribly good poker player sometimes. He can be. But he in this particular case, I mean, you could tell that, first of all, he hates listening to other people's speeches.
Yeah.
I mean, Vice President Biden used to speak endlessly before the president, and the president had to have Valerie Jarrett go tell Joe Biden's chief of staff to, like, can we stop this because I don't want to have to listen to these speeches. And so, you know, it's just like this final sort of curse to the president. The Holbrook sort of made him, like, listen to all 15 eulogies, many of them sort of taking thinly veiled shots.
Well, Clinton took a shot at Obama
at
the Holbrook eulogy.
He said the Richard Holbrook was good at doing. Well, people who didn't appreciate Richard Holbrook were not as good as doing, and people sort of took that as a shot. So
Mark, your book is kind of being likened a little bit to the Mark Halperin, John Heilman book, Game Change, and that was criticized in Washington in some circles for being too gossipy. The big difference in my mind is that you're willing to take on your peers. I mean, Game Change was about the campaign operatives and behind the scenes and all that John Edwards stuff. This is different because you're naming names. How have people responded to you? Andrea Mitchell, some of the even if you're
Mika and Joe,
well, they had me on.
Joe.
No, they had
me
on.
They came off well
in
your book.
Oh,
they basically ignored them. I mean, not for.
But what about some of those? You know, like Andrea Mitchell.
I don't think she liked the book. I've heard that secondhand. I mean, Andrea Mitchell. I actually knew she wasn't going to like it because I had a very, I would say, difficult fact-checking conversation with her. And look, self-awareness is not a huge...
That thing about being called Barbara Walters?
Well, that was actually in her own memoir. Part of the reporting here is actually reading memoirs that very few other people did read. So, I learned that there. But the... everyone loves a winner, right? I mean, there was a lot of resentment about Game Change, and yet everyone showed up at the grand opening for the Game Change movie on HBO. I think people... I've actually gotten quite a few emails from people who are not flatteringly portrayed in the book that have been surprisingly humble and surprisingly, wow, it was really important to look at myself that way. I mean, these are like senators and former senators and members of Congress. That was surprising. But there's most people just there have been a whole wave of people who wondered why they weren't in the book, a status kind of thing. A lot of people, I mean, Jay Carney, the White House press secretary, was asked in some briefing a couple weeks ago, have you read the Leibovich book? And he said, no, but I'm hoping to be invited to the book party. And
that's funny.
He was a funny line. And I sort of emailed him. I said, you know, you can come. It's like tomorrow night. And he goes, I can't believe I've been reduced to groveling from the podium. So people have, I mean, I don't think, well, again, I don't think people have fully internalized, you know, maybe the larger outrage is there. And Washington loves an event, and I guess if they want to see this as an event, they can.
We're talking to Mark Leibovich, who's just written This Town, Two Parties and a Funeral, about a very gilded, very over-the-top Capitol. Are there any heroes? You mentioned, and this sort of surprised me, Harry Reid, the Senate Majority Leader, is a more real that's not the right adjective. Yeah. What are the adjectives?
Harry Reid, I would certainly shy away from calling him or really anyone heroes, but people say he comes off. I mean, the thing I like about Harry Reid is there's something extremely honest about him in that he has no filter. He will say anything. He does not care have a care in the world about what anyone thinks of him, and it's one of the secrets to being in power. He will let all the show horses of his Democratic caucus get on TV, get the credit, do the sort of schmoozy thing that many senators are known for, as long as Harry Reid gets to be in charge. Harry Reid is I think, wouldn't say unappreciated, but people don't fully recognize the quirky, bizarre character that he is.
Because he's unimpressive when you see him on TV.
Oh, totally.
I mean, that's one.
And
you think this guy
him.
Used to be a big boxer. I mean, it's so hard to believe.
He's a bizarre character. I don't know. I mean, I like him because he's an original.
Is there anybody else like that doesn't care?
Tom Coburn is another senator, very conservative Republican. I mean, he and Reid hate each other. They despise each other. He's someone who I think is a bit of an anti-hero. He's been called the father of the Tea Party. I mean, it's funny because the people on both the left and the right have tried to claim this book or this notion of this permanent feudal class as their own. I mean, Coburn actually coined the term. But, I mean, I think those are two people who are pointed to as unlikely, you know, refreshing pieces of the book.
Now you talk about this analogy to Morgan Freeman in Shawshank Redemption.
Oh, and this
talks about being
chapter. Yeah. The Roach Motel of Power the chapter
and how,
heading.
And how people become institutionalized.
Right.
And how Barack Obama and his administration, when they first were marching towards the White House, said they will never bring lobbyists into the administration. It was a never, never, never scenario. And he has become as much of a Washington insider as witness bringing Bo on that helicopter over to the over to Martha's Vineyard.
Like, I know. Now, look, I mean, Washington, first of all, when you're a reelected president, I mean, I think as we're seeing, you kind of don't care anymore about the political niceties of where you put your dog on going on or where you go on vacation. But no, I mean, look, this administration was supposed to be different. I mean, the hope and change thing, I think, was probably sincere at the time. It was great marketing. But look, you keep saying never mind, like never mind that whole no lobbyists in the White House thing. No, never mind the we're not going to work with super PACs thing. I mean, if that happens, like if it keeps happening and happening, I mean, I'm allowed to be demoralized as a journalist, as a citizen. And look, I mean, they're all living in Washington. They ran against Washington and now they're all settling in, which is a very familiar story.
So should we be, again, concerned about this, that we need to do something, or is it just we just have to accept that everybody's in bed with everybody else and the lobbyists are there and it's all about millionaires and access? I mean, is it just hopeless?
It's funny. I hope not. I'm not a prescription guy. I mean, I'm not like a 10 bullet points at the end of the book in which I counsel everyone how the nation's capital can work better and we need term limits and we need campaign finance.
Do you think we do need term limits?
I don't know. Maybe. I mean, we need – look, we need – I actually – let me say this. I have a much greater sympathy for people on both sides who have a just out-and-out frustration and a belief that something completely new is necessary.
Well, you feel like – and I feel like this many times that you know, the great American century is behind us and we can't do anything anymore. And I really worry about, you know, my kids and my grandkids down the road, that it's just, we're just on a big downhill slide because of this sort of – it's all about getting reelected. It's all about money and –
It's self-interest. And it's about Washington. I mean, Washington, again, I'm parochial maybe because I live there. But it's a very important city. And it is as bad as we think. And it is, like as Coburn said, it's a permanent feudal class. It's a carnival. It's people who might come with the best intentions but who settle into it like a warm bath. And this is the wealthiest community in the United States right now. It's home to 7 of the wealthiest 10 counties in the United States right now, the Washington metropolitan area is. There's no There's no motivation to change. There's no motivation to get things done.
You have a great story in here about this kid, not a kid anymore, but Kurt Bardella.
Tell
us. Described as the most self-inflated press aide in the history of press aides. He worked for Daryl Issa. I had a nephew, by the way, who was the press aide to Anthony Weiner. Top that.
Really?
Yeah. But my point being, this bad behavior gets rewarded in so many circles, but this poor guy really took a hit, largely because of you.
Largely because of me, yeah. I was in the middle of this chapter. This was chapter, I think it's 8 or something like that.
Your chapter names are great, yeah. By the way.
I think this one was called How It Works. Kurt Bardella is the press secretary to Daryl Issa, who's the head of the Government Reform and Oversight Committee, a very powerful Republican on the Hill. Kurt is, you know, like many kind of sort of young, insecure people, very driven, came to Washington, wanted to reinvent himself. He loved West Wing. He's part of this generation of kids who don't grow up idolizing John F. Kennedy or Ronald Reagan. They grew up idolizing President Bartlett or Josh Lyman or something. Yes. Kurt was one of these. He said, I'm not so much a Democrat or Republican as I am an opportunist. And again, I kind of loved him for his transparency there. It was a little bit much after a while. But he started sending me these. He was one of my subjects for this chapter. He started sending me emails from reporters, from members of Congress, as a way of showing me a window into how he spent his days. And eventually Politico learned about this. It became a massive scandal on Capitol Hill in a week in which the Republicans were threatening to shut down the government. And this was the only story in town. Of course, no one here remembers it or even knows about it because, I mean, we really didn't matter. But hundreds of stories were written about it, and I just sort of took that as a narrative of really, I mean, he got fired. He got fired. Yeah. He came back into his old job, I think at a higher salary.
6 months later.
6 months later. He got asked to go on CNN as a talking head to talk about birtherism. He was invited to parties. I mean, people saw him on the street. They forgot what he was infamous for. But they said, hey, you know, you're somebody. And that's the way it works.
Story.
You get this neutral sheen of notoriety rather than any kind of sense that you've done wrong.
Well, you talk about the four things that have changed. So the lobbyists, that's a big, huge thing. The 24-hour news hole with cable is the celebrity. Everybody's a celebrity thing. What's the fourth thing?
Let's see. What is the fourth thing?
It's like, what's his name? Rick Perry.
Yeah, although I think I'm trying
your
to think
Rick Perry moment.
Okay, so lobbying, just celebrity. Oh, new media.
Oh, new media. Okay,
I mean,
so
I
Twitter,
think
Facebook, everybody
all
wanted
that
to be
is
on
exaggerated.
That.
Again, it has made the sort of self-branding craze. I mean, anyone can be famous. Mm. Anyone can develop a second act. You can monetize. That's a terrible new Washington word, but I mean, everyone knows. You can monetize your identity to a degree that which you never could before. So again, it rewards self-interest instead of public service.
You know, you had a great quote here, and this I found depressing too, from Rahm Emanuel. He was a big aide in the White House, and
chief of staff.
Yeah,
chief
of staff.
Mayor of Chicago.
And now he's the mayor of Chicago. Listen to this: a man never stands taller than when he is down on all fours kissing somebody's. I'm going to paraphrase you, derriere.
Sucking up. That's suck up city.
He would never ever
city.
Use the word derriere.
No, he did not use
right
the word
now.
Derriere. He used a different word, but we're not going to use
that. That's the other thing. Yes. Language. That's a whole other thing.
Language
down there.
Yes.
And that sort of encapsulated the suck up city chapter.
Oh, totally. Now, look, sycophanticness. What's the word?
Whatever it is.
It greases everything. And, I mean, look, it's one of the things I hate about it. Again, it's you get used to being spoken to in a language that most people don't realize is abnormal. I mean, people in Washington don't realize is abnormal. It's obsequiousness. It's browbeating sometimes. It's just very, very unctious kind of back and forth. And yeah, it wears you down.
So. Yeah, I was last week when that's the second round of the Anthony Weiner thing broke. When that aide wrote the note back
that got printed.
That's the way they talk to each other. That's not unusual to use the F word every third word in these. This is Congress. This is staff.
Oh, no. Anthony Weiner is notorious for that. I mean, he was not a very pleasant guy to work for back when he was in Congress. But again, look, I mean, I don't think he's going to win now, but he, Elliot Spitzer, Mark Sanford, I mean, it's all a great example of how the unemployment line in politics is not very long. I mean, if and when Anthony Weiner loses, I mean, there's no – I'd hardly be shocked if he got a great – radio gig or cable gig or book deal or something like that. No, he'll be fine. I mean, I don't know if his wife and you're going to stay together.
So, but, Mark Leibovich, author of This Town. One last thing, because we got to go in just a few seconds. Are you going to stay in Washington for the rest of your career? Do you think you might relocate to New York?
I don't know. If I'm driven out of town, maybe that's part of the master plan. I mean, look, it sounds like a contradiction. I mean, we have a nice life there. Our kids like their schools. Okay. My wife likes her job. So there I am for now.
Okay. Mark Leibovich, new book, and you got to get it and you got to read it. It is great. This Town, Two Parties and a Funeral, plus plenty of valet parking in America's Gilded Capital. You can catch Mark again tonight on Greater Boston with Emily Rooney at 7 o'clock. Mark, again, thank you very much for being with us. And thank you all for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in tomorrow for Open Mic with Christopher Lydon. Our show is a production of WGBH.